Welcome to Community Alert. Not if, but when. Positive preparation for disaster with Ted Adams and Mike Williams. Keeping you informed on how to get ready and be prepared. Tuesdays at 11 a.m. and 9 p.m. and Saturdays at 1 p.m. on AM 1290, the Santa Barbara News Press radio station.
Good morning, folks. Welcome to Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams and my co-host is Mike Williams. Today we're visiting with Kate Dargan and Ronnie Coleman, both former California State Fire Marshals. We're really happy to have you guys here. This is going to be a fun show. These guys have got lots of germane information for us, and we're looking forward to it. Real quick, I want to do something. I want to say that after my article in the paper yesterday, I got an email from Jack Armstrong, who's a former career firefighter, and he is a community a leader in Santa Barbara. And he pointed out to me that I made an erroneous statement in the paper, and I want to correct that. And that is, I was telling people that they could drink the water from their swimming pools. And it was pointed out to me that that's a big no-no. And I went on the Center for Disease Control and read about it. And they said that, you know, you certainly should not drink the water from the swimming pool because there are chemicals in that water that will not come out, and they aggregate in some conditions and it can be dangerous. So that water can only be used for cleansing and not for drinking. So I wanted to make sure that the people knew that I had made that mistake.
Well, with that, you're going to take five laps around the station.
I'll do it.
Or around the pool.
Yeah, or in the pool. Yeah, exactly.
So, Mike, what's going on?
Well, we got a couple of announcements here before we get into today's festivities. First of all, about the car seats, we've been putting out that website, and here it comes again. This is with Santa Barbara County Fire. It'd be carseats@sbcfire.com. That's carseats@sbcfire.com. You can also go to the CHP site, which is cdph@ca.gov. That's cdph.ca.gov, and that's for car seats, and very definitely. We started doing this last week, and I pulled it off this morning because I got up and I went to my email, and the first thing there was from the United States Fire Administration, and we got 1, 3, 4, 5, 6 people died yesterday in structure fires.
Oh, boy.
And it's amazing to me because, like we were talking about it last night at dinner, you have all this statistical information, but it starts taking on a real human interest in a real manner when you start looking at Bloomington, New Mexico, and Portsmouth, place you can't even pronounce, in Ohio, Arizona, New Mexico, folks dying primarily in their bedrooms.
Yeah, and preventable fires, most likely.
So with that came the follow-up with the U.S. Fire Administration as winter storm fire safety. And one of the things they're promoting is do not use kitchen ovens or ranges to heat your home. And we don't think much about that, but absolutely you shouldn't be doing that. We've talked repeatedly about using barbecues inside the house.
Always use
a flashlight, not candles, and that's something that we see here locally, people using candles for lighting and or heating. If there's a fire hydrant near your home, keep it clear of snow and debris and easy access by the fire department. Now, snow's not an issue for us, but all that overgrown brush that covers up all those plug heads that we have up on the hill, need to think about that. Never refuel a space heater while it's operating or still hot, and alternate heaters need their space. Keep anything that can burn at least 3 feet away, those space heaters that you get from Home Depot and Osh and what have you. And if you haven't done it yet, now's a good time to change the battery in your CO detector and or smoke detector. And finally, the website of the day, and we're going to talk a little bit about this, we're not going to get into it heavily, but this is regarding the SRA fees. You can go to www.bof.fire.ca.gov, and we'll give this out again, and it'll also be on the website, but that's bof.fire.ca.gov. And with that, let's jump into the show. Thank you both for coming all the way down from Sacramento yesterday to be with us today.
My pleasure. I know it's Chief Coleman's pleasure, too. So happy to be here.
Well, you both wrote an article that caught our attention, and I've been trying to get you both down here at the same time for some time, Wildfire Past, Present, and Future. And we kind of wanted to dive into that. And part of what caught my attention and where I wanted to start is the whole discussion of wildland interface goes all the way back to as far back as the 1700s, but it was the 1910 firestorm that really broke it open. And why did you guys pick that? What was so unique about 1910, the big burn that caused everything to suddenly get noticed? Kate?
I'll start off, but I think, you know, Ronnie here is one of the best fire historians in the state, so his answer probably will be a little bit more detailed than mine. But the short answer from my perspective, one is we've watched a policy change over the years, but it really was kind of ignited for this 100-year comparison by the publication of Tim Egan's book, the New York Times columnist, called The Big Burn. And Tim has done a number of historical novels, not novels, but historical books over the years, and he published The Big Burn, chronicling that 1910 fire and a little bit of the 100 years after, and it really just seemed a great time to write an article around that theme.
Ronnie, I know you expand on that.
Well, my perspective was slightly different on this. I didn't approach it so much from the fire as I approached it from the public policy point of view. What got me started with it was reading the life history of Theodore Roosevelt. I do a lot of research into what I call the formative years of different things like the military and the fire service and so forth. And I started my adventure on this by examining the relationship between Gifford Pinchot and Teddy Roosevelt in 1910. And then that was reinforced by there was a guy named Stephen Pine that has written numerous books on fires. And when I started reading these two books kind of back to back, I suddenly saw the nexus between the shift in philosophy and the political realities and Teddy Roosevelt's attitude about resource management. And of course, everybody remembers that this was also at a time of major political transition in this country. We had expanded to the West Coast, and Manifest Destiny had played itself out and all this other stuff. So I got involved in examining this from a public policy point of view, and that's what got me to looking into when did some of these things start, why did they start, what was the outcome, that sort of thing.
Well, one of the things I noticed when reading through your article, and it occurred to me that one of the big differences between then and today was that timber was considered a national resource in a big way. And, of course, today we don't see it that way. It's mostly recreational areas that have the timber. And there is managed timber, but it's nothing the way it was at that time. And so they were trying to protect that, I think, when they were putting all of that put-out-every-fire policy.
Well, from my point of view, just to jump onto that about the economic aspect of it, Roosevelt, as everybody knows, was the icon for conservation. And everything to him was about protecting and preserving, and he had a real concern about what was going to happen to the forest assets in this country. And that was back in the days when, I think I made a comment earlier this morning, is we might have had a fire and burnt down a mining camp. Today we have a fire and burn down a town.
Right.
It was
right.
Significantly different.
Right.
And our towns today are million-dollar homes.
Yeah.
They're not cabins up on the side of the hill. Well, what's interesting here is a quote from H.M. Sutter, who was there at the beginning. And the policy that came out from there was, according to Sutter, the first objective in the forest protection was to extinguish small fires promptly, thus avoid the great expenditures inherent to well-high, hopeless, and struggles with conflagrations. And that's pretty much been the Forest Service mantra ever since. And I think the controversies today all center around that very issue there of keep all small fires small, and it's not necessarily possible.
Well, it does, and it still is shaping some of the big policy discussions that are going on, whether or not, this is back to fire is a beneficial part of an ecosystem, especially mm-hmm. in the Mediterranean climates. How do our policies across the U.S. Account for the fact that fire is part of a renewed sustainable landscape. And there is this debate that goes back and forth between the philosophy of absolute fire suppression, which is keep all fires small, suppress all fires, versus what we now know, and the science continues to grow, where fire is part of a sustained landscape, and without its presence, our habitat, our wildlife species, our plant regenerations, those things don't happen the way nature intends them to. And the unintended consequence of fire exclusion is causing us problems today.
Well, Ron, you come from the Marine Corps. So the statement that went in here about how firefighting has been approached from a paramilitary tactical point of view since its inception. And then there's a quote in here in the article about when wildfires burned homes, it was considered to be collateral damage and secondary to protecting the forest. It's consistent with a military philosophy, the betterment of the all. Do you think the paramilitary mentality is counterproductive to the wildfire management in reality, or is it the necessity of how they move that many large resources?
Well, I'll respond a little bit about that, about the paramilitary aspects. I don't think the paramilitary aspect of the fire service started with the wildland problem.
No.
It started with the construct of the American Fire Service, the pattern that we put together, the chief and the chain of command and all this other stuff. I think that evolved into a philosophy of mobilization and deployment that has a military-like atmosphere.
The incident command.
The incident command. In fact, right. The incident command system, a lot of people don't realize, actually came out of the invasion of Europe in World War II.
Right.
That was the original construct of the ICS. But the other issue, which I kind of wanted to focus on just for a little bit about this idea of ecological balance, is what's interesting, if you go back and read the history of California, you'll find out that the Indians systematically burned off the mountains so they'd have adequate regrowth for their basket making and for their hunting and so forth.
A lot of fruit sources came out of those fires because all the small plants would grow and then they get the seeds and things.
We're up to our first break already. We're visiting with both retired State Fire Marshal Ronnie Coleman and Kate Dargan. Website of the day, bof.fire.ca.gov. Ted Adams, Mike Williams, and Richard Dugan working the slide pots for us today on Community Alert, Not If But When, Positive Preparation for Disaster on your station, KZSB AM 1290, Santa Barbara News Press Radio, live on the internet at newspress.com. Back in just a moment.
Hey folks, welcome back to Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams, as usual. And today we're visiting with Kate Dargan and Ronnie Coleman, both former State of California fire marshals, and getting right into some of the strong, interesting parts of the fire service and policy making. And like that. Welcome, you guys. Great to have you with us.
Thank you.
Mike, have you
got the website out again, because it's kind of one of those convoluted state websites. It's bof.fire.ca.gov. That's bof.fire.ca.gov.
And also, B as in dog, is that?
B as in boy, is Board of Fire Services.
Okay.
And then also, for those that have been asking, I've been getting a lot of requests for 20 weeks to preparedness, and you can get that right online at Goleta Prepare Now at the City of Goleta. That would be cityofgoleta.org. You can get it at wildlandresidents.org. You can also get it at the San Ynez Valley CERT website. It's all online. Great little brochure here on things to get ready for. But getting back into the wildland-urban interface, it seems to me that there's two conflicting forces. There's the environmental and the human side of it all, which is somewhat on the intellectual side of the page. And then there's the suppression side, which is all paramilitary and airplanes and trucks and bodies and all of those kinds of things. Seems to me that somewhere in there, that's where the conflict is occurring, is that those two people or organizational groups are not resonating well with each other. What can we do to try to bring that around so that it does work? Ronnie, what do you think of?
Well, Kate and I are kind of interesting to be on the same show together, because we actually come from very diverse backgrounds. She's a wildland person with an infinite amount of credentials in that, and I'm a structure guy with a lot of amount of credentials in that. And 30 years ago, when we both started our careers, the wildland guys and the structure guys hardly even talked to each other. Today, we are intimately involved with each other because of the fact that when we have these major deployments today, there's nobody exempt. That we can't sit behind and say, well, we're not going to go beyond the city boundary, you know, and they're not going to come in our area. So from my perspective, the one kind of responding to your question here is the fact that the system is changing. The means of coping with this problem is different now than it was in 1910. We're talking billions of dollars of fire suppression costs. We're talking the amount of money that it takes to do clearance around homes and things of this nature is drastically different than it was before. That's why there's no straightforward, real simple, off-the-shelf answer.
Right.
Well, California takes these a little different perspective on these anyway, because our urban interface is so well populated with very expensive homes and a lot of industry. You go into other parts of the country, up in Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, and those areas, and it's much more sparsely, and the attitude is certainly different, and the amount of resources that are available that are different. And yet, the overall governing philosophy seems to be pretty much the same.
It is the same, and the reason for that is that wildland firefighting, by and large, and this is back to the 1910 nexus for the show, has been managed politically and organizationally and policy-wise by federal agencies. And because federal agencies established a nationwide coast-to-coast model for wildland firefighting, the states, as the states populated, kind of grew up as little brothers and sisters, mm-hmm. so to speak, of that larger federal organization. So no surprise that the philosophy, the policies, and the organizational strategies were very much just mimicries, not mimicries in a bad way, but you know, similar to the parent organization.
Well, what we've been seeing, and we talked about this off air, and what we're seeing today is that they're including now the private sector much more in involvement, and that's what the Fire Safe Council does, and there are other entities around the country. But I think that what's happening is that everyone is recognizing the fact that people that live in an area have far more information about that area than anyone coming in to do suppression work or anything like that, and now they're becoming included in the process. And that kind of goes against that whole, the federal big brother, that whole thing, because now it's more grassroots. I mean, it's coming up from the bottom rather than coming down from the top, which makes it a healthier environment. I think it's an interesting thing that's happening. What do you think about that?
Well, I think you're pointing at a very interesting change that I think is going on now, not just in the wildland fire arena relative to Fire Safe Councils and citizen involvement, but really questions about how government and community interacts.
Right.
And that's a, you know, but let's just keep this narrowed to fire departments and fire safe councils. And
that's complicated enough.
Right. But nonetheless, I think it really serves as a window into how we're talking about changing our governmental structures from being paternalistic, we take care of you, you don't need to think about anything, we'll take care of it all, to, you know what, we really can't sustain that kind of a big overhead. We need to get people more engaged in managing their lives. And so fire safe councils help communities understand their problem, figure out their solutions, and then if it's working well, they partner with their local fire departments in a collaborative, positive way.
Exactly.
And that's changing fire departments. They're learning how to be less closed and more open to individuals being an everyday part of decision making.
Yeah, and the fitting this discussion is a concept. There's a group called the World Future Society. They have a motto: think globally, but act locally. This is a huge problem. It's an international problem. The urban wildland interface is not restricted to the United States. Australia has a serious problem. Italy, Greece, you know, et cetera. But the solution is not from the top down. The solution is from the bottom up. Now, I'll speak just a little bit to the effect of we have made huge inroads in building standards. The building codes have been modified over the last 20 years to significantly improve the defensibility of houses. But if you don't remove the fuel in the defensible space and crowd that stuff up, right up against even the best building standards in the country, you're going to have a problem.
Exactly.
And so Kate and I certainly subscribe to at least one theory, and that is that this problem is solved from the bottom up, not from the top down.
Well, absolutely. Ronnie and I have been working extensively with volunteer fire departments throughout California, and I've always felt that the fire safe councils are a huge component of the volunteer fire service in the rural area, because there's so much interrelation and crossover. And one of the things that's difficult to do is to get volunteer fire departments to even use the word prevention. And the idea that they probably would be better off focusing much more on the prevention aspect, because they have limited resources, limited manpower, limited equipment, limited budgets. Everything about them is limited except enthusiasm and spirit. Put that to work and try to mitigate what these fires are going to do to you based on the premise that you're more or less there to hold the fort until the cavalry arrives anyway. Make it in a situation where it's going to be easier to manage for a lot less grief. And it's a challenge. We were just up in Plumas County. Those guys get it up there. There's a lot going on up in Plumas. We're up to our next break already, and I wanted to thank our sponsors. Most importantly, of course, the California Fire Safe Council out of Sacramento, along with the Santa Barbara County Fire Safe Council. Cold Spring Tavern for a great dinner. We were there just last night, 967-0066. Service Master anytime. You got a disaster, give them a call. They'll clean line it up, 688-2399. California State Firefighters Association, a fire services training institute, providing a lot of technical background for the show. Paul Cashman, State Farm Insurance, 687-6666. And finally, our friends over at the Montecito Fire Protection District, Mirage, 969-2537, if you live in that area and you want to get involved. Until then, Ted Adams, Mike Williams, will be back in just a moment on Community Alert, KZSB AM 1290, your Santa Barbara News Press Radio and newspress.com.
Folks, welcome back to Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams. And today we're visiting with Kate Dargan and with Ronnie Coleman. Both of them are past fire marshals for the state of California and getting into some really interesting areas of talking about what's going on around the state and around the country and around the world in the fire suppression and fire preparation areas. And I think we're going to get involved. Now, talking a little bit about the Fire Safe Council, Mike, what do you...
Well, let's jump in. Kate, you're on the state board for the Fire Safe Council. What are they doing right now, and what's the future of the Fire Safe Councils in California?
Well, that's a mixed review right now. The statewide Fire Safe Council wears two hats. One is a board that works to further the mission of educating Californians about the risks, mitigations, and prevention of wildland fire. So it wears its educational advocacy hat. And then the second hat it wears is the Grants Clearinghouse, where it takes it serves as the point where multiple agencies, federal and state, can put money into a grant, basically a grant bucket, and then there's a process by which all the local fire safe councils apply and receive grants through the clearinghouse. It's a more efficient way to do the grants management process than to have each agency try to do them separately around the state. So the Fire Safe Council is very busy with both of those activities. Now, the mixed part of the answer is the grant world, which is primarily federal dollars, not much private, very little state dollars. I think that might be zero state dollars in fire prevention in terms of grant process, with the exception of some of the fuels management,
right.
Prop 84 type watershed grants. Those dollars are declining and rapidly, and no surprise. We're looking at the deficit discussions that are coming out of Washington, D.C., and all of the federal agencies, and primarily the U.S. Forest Service, are having a very difficult time defending and justifying, I guess, the dollars that go to these kinds of grant programs back to the budget managers in Washington, D.C., because traditionally fire prevention is one of the first things that gets sliced when budget cuts come. Whether you're a federal firefighting organization or a very small one. And so we do see a downward trend in those grant dollars that means local fire safe councils will have less available to them in the years ahead.
Yeah, one of the things that here locally, the local fire safe council in Santa Barbara is extraordinarily active and has been all the way back to day one when Herb McElway and the guys started it. And the all the fire agencies are participants in it, but it has a huge local community participation level, and it has been instrumental in the formation of other homeowners associations, not determining what color you're going to paint your house, but how you're going to deal with your fuel management programs and impact on everybody locally. And it's been great, and we've been able to bring in the academic community. We got the Botanic Gardens, UCSB, Forest Service, Cal Fire, and to get all those folks in the same room talking about the same thing in a non-confrontational environment is somewhat unique, especially in the fire service. It's working for us, but the lack of funding is becoming problematic. And the question then becomes, well, why do I need a fire safe council if there's not any money? Because we formed our fire safe council strictly to be a pass-through between federal funding and cutting our brush. And that's becoming somewhat of a discouraging element, I think. I was down in Riverside at the farmers' presentation, and a lot of folks were started talking that way. It's like, well, if they cut off the money, then why do we need to do all of this? And I would submit that it's all the more reason to get stronger and do more. Because you've got to maintain what you've done.
Doesn't that bring the state responsibility area fee structure perhaps into the conversation where we're looking at having this $150 fee on property owners that live within the state responsibility area, which are like the wildland areas. And that fee money in some respects would be transferred perhaps into some sort of a grant structure that would allow the fire safe councils perhaps to allocate those funds to the public as same way that we've been making application for the federal funds. We could do that same thing with those SRA funds. And maybe you'd talk about that a little bit, King.
Yes, the legislation that was passed last year, we'll just call it the SRA fire prevention fee, does require that homeowners with houses in the SRA area pay a $150 fee annually to the state. It's a fee collection. But the law describes or prescribes that that money be collected and spent only on fire prevention. And
in the area in which it's collected, is that correct?
Yeah, the law requires that the beneficiaries of those who paid the money have to receive the benefit. Now, it also recognizes that CAL FIRE is a statewide organization that provides fire prevention as well. So they do have a legitimate part of that solution, but it also needs to return to local entities, whether they're local fire districts or local fire safe councils. And the law does set aside a grants process specifically for fire prevention. And this is an enormously controversial piece of legislation. It's already a passed law, so we should talk about it as a law at the moment. And it really is getting to the heart of a question that you were raising, Mike. As the federal government steps away from funding 100% of these activities that fire safe councils, let's call it a very large percentage. It's not maybe perhaps quite 100%, but certainly 90%+. As the federal government steps away from that and looks to states and communities to be somewhat more self-sustaining financially in terms of those goals, the question is, will we rise to that? Will our communities and will we as a state choose to invest dollars in fire prevention specifically to mitigate wildland fires?
Well, it's important that the intent of the law, and I'm reading it right off the legislative review here, the law addresses prevention. This is not a law that addresses protection or suppression. And I think that's a huge distinction that hasn't been talked about publicly anyway, at least communally around here, that this isn't about more fire trucks, more bodies, more helicopters, more airplanes, more DC-10s, all of that. This is about more fuel mitigation, more clearing of brush, more widening of roads, more public education, more what to do, more evacuation plans, that kind of thing, which isn't all the fun and games and noise and hoopla, but that's the thing that actually does, in fact, save lives. And we were talking about with Ronnie before the show about the fire service protecting property and lives. Well, realistically, in a wildfire, the lives have been removed from the equation for the most part because you evacuate them. Now what are we doing? We're protecting those homes, which has a collective interest of the banks, the insurance companies, the communities, the property owners, and those kinds of folks. But Ronnie, you were talking also about that this is not really a new law. The concept of this goes back quite some time ago. What's the history of this?
Well, the whole idea of who's paying for fire protection and when they're going to pay for it is not an argument that's been raised in the last 4 or 5 years. It goes back, clear back probably as early as the 1940s. As these things have grown, there's always been a disconnect sometimes between who pays for fire protection and who gets fire protection. I'm going to speak just a little bit kind of abstract thought here for just a few seconds, but the very concept that you talked about protecting property, I give you at least one mathematical formula. There's more houses in California than there are fire trucks. Okay? Very simple statement. There's more houses than there are fire trucks. So when you have a fire, you got to have a certain number of fire trucks to go protect those pieces of property. When we talk about prevention, what prevention literally means is making sure that that an event does not occur that results in the destruction of other people's property, right? So now we're talking about managing risk per se. It's not just, we're not going, don't play with matches. You know, people think that's fire prevention. Fire prevention is much more complex than don't play with matches. If you don't mind me kind of using another paraphrase, you heard that statement, it takes a community to raise a child. Well, it takes a community to protect a neighborhood. And this whole thought process about funding and balance is one of equity. It's not really one of necessity. It's one of figuring out who's going to pay for it and when they're going to pay for it.
Well, that's one of the mantras on this show repeatedly is who's going to pay, who's going to pay, who's going to pay. Mm-hmm. And we've yet to ever get an email, a letter, or a telephone call with any suggestions of who's going to pay. It's always want, or how come, or what for, or what have you. With that, we're going to take our next break. Community Alert, sponsored in large part by the California Fire Safe Council. Website of the week, bof.fire.ca.gov. That's bof.fire.ca.gov. And you can get copies of all this SRA information right off the Board of Forestry Fire Protection website. It's all right there. Ted Adams, Mike Williams, Richard Dugan. We'll be back in just a minute on Community Alert, Not If But When, Positive Preparation for Disaster on KZSB AM 1290.
Hey, folks, welcome back to Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams. And today we're visiting with the former fire marshals of the state of California, both Kate Dargan and Ronnie Coleman. We're in that position for quite some time.
Well, let's go in. We had a couple phone calls during the break here, and they all brought up good questions. And one has to do with personal responsibility and defensible space and protecting your neighbor and whatever. We're going to get into that just a little bit more. Ronnie is going to jump on that. The other call asking about animals used in fire prevention, absolutely. Goats in particular. There are other things. Goats are used extensively throughout Santa Barbara. There's a couple of companies that are participants in the Santa Barbara Fire Safe Council that actually come to all the meetings. Mm-hmm. Goats were an issue during the Hayes-Aceta fire. We can talk about that on another show. There are no waivers to the fee that we're aware of at this time. And I mention again, go to that website. Everything you want to know about this as of today is there. That's bof.fire.ca.gov. And you can download the same thing we're looking at right now. And the other thing was folks that are disabled or the elderly or the incapacitated that need to do this clearing, many of the fire safe councils are helping those folks out specifically with grant monies. I don't know of anything specifically here in Santa Barbara because it's not a big issue. I know for a fact in Trinity County that it's being done extensively because so much of the population up there is unable to do the kind of clearing. And also, you're talking about timber up there, and you don't clear timber like you do your four-foot plants in the front yard. So thank you guys for calling in. Those are all important things.
Yeah, Richard. And
jumping back to the issue of personal responsibility, Ronnie, you were getting into that. Let's continue with that thought.
Well, what I was trying to emphasize is the fact that when an event occurs, it's your home that's potentially going to be the loss. Okay, it's your home. It's not your neighbor's. It's not some stranger. It's your home. And personal accountability starts with keeping that house as defensible as possible. If I was able to, you know, just use a kind of magic wand and pull up to someone and say, we know for a fact that there's a big fire going to come through here a week from now, and in 1 week you can do everything to this house that you possibly can to make sure it survives, nobody would turn that down. But you can't do it when the fire is 3 hours away.
Right.
No. Defensible space, building construction features, and all of those kinds of things are highly dependent upon people's attitudes about, is it ever going to happen to me? And the comment I made earlier about it takes a community to protect a neighborhood, let's say we got three neighbors here, and neighbor in the middle has excellent defensible space and does everything right, and neighbor on the left side doesn't do anything whatsoever, and the neighbor on the right side only does half of it. Well, the problem is the guy in the middle is still vulnerable. And that's why it's important that we understand that while it's nice to think in terms of massive deployment of firefighting resources, homes burn down one at a time because they're not defensible.
Well, you know, it's interesting you bring that up because South Lake Tahoe is a great example of that kind of scenario where everybody did everything up to a point, and then there was this no man's zone, if you will, where they weren't allowed to do anything, and that was what took out the community. We had Chief Gigalotti down here at a Fire Safe Council meeting talking about that very thing, and I remember him showing a picture taken from the inside of his truck as he was going to the incident command post that was set up in a park out there. You see this plume coming up out of the trees, and he made the comment that there's not a fire chief on the planet that wants to have to drive to one of these when it's in his own town. And he was emphasizing that you do this all the time through mutual aid. You're always going to everybody else's stuff. But But when it's in your front yard and it's your city manager or county administrator calling you and it's your risk manager and it's your media people screaming, it takes on a whole different perspective. And, you know, they tried up there. They've tried in a lot of counties trying to do more than they've been able to. And I think that's where the equilibrium is yet to set. How can we be more effective in getting through some of the roadblocks that are thrown up for doing fuel mitigation and prevention?
Well, let's see. I think the most efficient way to get folks all on the same page is to get them looking at simple views or simple pictures of what their communities look like. Because when you start with, I've done this over and over and over again with communities. I was intimately engaged as the chair of the Tahoe Fire Commission post-Angora with the fire that you're speaking mm-hmm. of. And when you start with a relatively simple look of what a community looks like, let's just call it the San Marcos Pass area here, and you really start to point out to people exactly where the issues are, which fuels, which roads, and you start looking at houses, and folks can see their house in a format that makes sense to them. Not a little cartoon picture, but let's say you're going to Google Earth and you're taking a look at their house and you're pointing out to them exactly what trees are specifically at risk for them or what roadways really need to be best cleared for evacuation purposes. I have never seen a community not figure it out really quick.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that I advocate for is to step back, to really get this drilled down to a community action perspective, is to really spend some energy getting our information and our data assembled in a way that's easy to share with people. And that's like taking advantage of what we have with our technology tools out there. A lot of us use Google Maps or Google Earth or other products. You know, we use them all the time. I drove here today when you gave me the address mm-hmm. for the studio location. We're not using those technologies with this problem yet.
That's why we're, of course, very great advocates of the Community Wildfire Protection Plan. Mm-hmm. And once you start looking at that Community Wildfire Protection Plan and your particular community and look at it from the perspective of Google Earth and start looking at where the brush is and where what needs to be cleared, you get a unique perspective. And I think it's at everybody's fingertips today. I mean, you can Google your home and then back away from it and you can see where the problems are. It's pretty easy.
Yeah. One point I'd like to make is that there's a tendency sometimes for people to think that when we're talking about these concepts, we're talking about a scorched earth policy, that we're going to cut down everything, that we're going to ruin the lifestyle and so forth. And I'd like to put a little historical perspective on this. I've got photographs in my collection of what California looked like in the 1870s and the 1880s. It doesn't look like it does today. Mm-hmm. And the reason why is that fire was a regime that was managed a little bit differently back in those days. That was pre-1910, obviously. But we're not talking about people coming through with just eradicating everything. We're talking about balance, and we're talking about personal. Let's go back to that personal accountability. If every man's home is his castle, then that home ought to be got a moat around it.
Mm-hmm.
That moat is defensible space. And that's what we're talking about. The more people who really truly believe that and start paying attention to the information material about how to manage your fuels and so forth. We're not talking about going back to something that's stark or that's unlivable. We're talking about something that's manageable and survivable.
Well, when I'm implementing the grant funding and when I'm going into neighborhoods and getting people to do the work around their homes, I always talk about the park-like setting, like where you can walk out into the chaparral and be able to, or into whatever surrounds your home, and be able to have separation between the trees, so that you can go out and have a picnic in the area. You're not walking through brush. And I think that's something that we need to get people to understand, is that's kind of that mosaic, that trimming back, separating trees from each other, that sort of thing. And it's quite lovely. And we've done that quite a bit in the mountains, and it makes a really beautiful environment and enhances the environment, because you can see with depth the rock formations, and you know the game can move through it easily, and you find more game coming into the area. I mean, it's really really adds to the area. So,
Kate, you had something.
I want to plug the firefighting effort into this, whether it's now or when we come back from the break?
Yeah, when we come back from the break, we'll do that because we're up at our next break. Visiting today with both former state fire marshals, Ronnie Coleman and Kate Dargan, and we're talking about the wildland interface and the fires and history and just a little bit of everything. Want to also thank our other sponsors, Arts and Letters Cafe, which is where we're headed as soon as the bell rings here. On Community Alert with Ted Adams, Mike Williams, this is KZSB AM 1290.
Welcome back, folks, to Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams, and today we're visiting with the former state fire marshals, Kate Dargan, excuse me, and Ronnie Coleman, and covering a whole lot of area here. Interesting stuff about the history and present workings of the fire suppression and clearing in California.
Let's get into the last break here, but 1928 was an interesting year because the Oakland and Berkeley fires, and out of that sprang the office in which you both held, the State Fire Marshal's Office. What happened? What are they doing today?
Let's see. About just a little under 20 years ago, this Office of the State Fire Marshal's The office of the state fire marshal merged with CAL FIRE, and so the state fire marshal and CAL FIRE are linked in terms of one organization. But the state fire marshal really serves as an advocate and a leader within the fire service for local fire chiefs around the state. And if they have a representative in Sacramento relative to fire service training, which is a responsibility of the state fire marshal's office in training volunteer and career paid firefighters around the state. It also has branches that handle pipeline safety, which was, of course, quite a big concern after the San Bruno explosion last year. It handles fire investigations. It assists local governments with arson investigation and bomb issues. We have a very robust part of the fire marshal's office, which handles building inspections for the public types of buildings around the state of California. And then we have a code section that deals with the building and fire codes for the state. And that's something that in the wildland world, they've been very engaged with Chief Coleman, and he can talk about it here in a minute, on the heels of the tunnel fire in Oakland in 1991, really started cutting national ground, plowing national ground, developing a wildland urban interface building code, the results of which we have in place in California today as a statewide leader amongst other states in the country. And Chief Coleman?
Yeah, actually, you mentioned about the Berkeley Hills fire being in the 1920s. The California State Fire Marshal's Office got its creation about that same time frame. And it's kind of interesting to watch the evolution of how things have gone over the years of enhancing building standards and so forth. The State Fire Marshal's Office did, as Kate mentioned, file for a federal grant to put together the Urban Wildland Interface Code, and that was back during the days when we were first talking about integrating the State Fire Marshal's Office into CAL FIRE, which has been successfully accomplished. And what it does, it marries up two very, very critical concepts. One is building codes and standards and fire prevention codes, and a statewide firefighting agency that has implications almost everywhere you look. And so California, I think, is uniquely positioned to address the urban wildland issue in comparison to other states. Other states, they're still treating them as fragmented policies, and California, I think, is a leader in that capacity.
Well, if people out there would like a copy of your article, Wildland, Past, Present, and Future, they can get a copy of it at fpemag.com. That's fpemag.com. You want the third quarter of 2010, and it's a great article. It's a quick read. It's not terribly long, but it has a terrible amount or a tremendous amount of history in here.
I prefer tremendous over terrible.
Yeah, I do too. Slip of the tongue. Tremendous amount of information in a very short period of time about how we got to where we are today. And the intriguing part of it, you didn't talk about the Bel Air fire. There were a lot of other major significant fires in there. Very little has changed as far as the discussion on what works, what doesn't work, what we should do and what we shouldn't do. Right.
One thing that Kate hasn't had a chance to talk about, but in that article she talks about shaping the battleground. Mm-hmm. And we had metaphors of the military, et cetera, et cetera. And I think one of the more critical aspects of what we're sitting here talking about is how to change the future by doing things today.
And I know that we've talked a lot about what are the changes. Some changes are coming, and not everybody's paying any attention. They're here. They're at the front door.
Every change that we talk about in this article is arriving. Mm-hmm. Some are still 10 years out, but for those of us who really enjoy watching long-distance horizons in terms of public policy, we can find evidence of all of these things in motion right now.
And for our caller that was talking about personal accountability, stand by to stand by, because it's coming in all kinds of directions. It's not just the fire service.
All going to be very integrally involved.
You know, and as we start to wrap up, there's one thing that I want to circle back to, it's not give a nod to, but it's to make sure it's clear in the public's mind. As we really advocate for fire prevention, fire safe councils, community involvement, we never should take our eye off of the firefighting force.
Absolutely.
Because what we're trying to accomplish in California, I mean, when you saw the Hazelcita fire ripping over the hillside in Santa Barbara, no amount of home preparation is going to negate that mm-hmm. force of nature. But what we are trying to do is create a community that our firefighters can effectively defend. And that's a hand in glove. That's a 1-2 marriage.
And with that, we should be plugged to the County Fire Department and all the fire chiefs in Santa Barbara and their Ready, Set, Go program, and that there's a place for everybody, but getting out of the way is your first objective as a citizen. I want to thank you both for taking time to come down
Absolutely.
Here from Sacramento, and I'm sorry it's only an hour show, but this has been tremendous. For people that have any questions, send us an email at community@wildlandresidents.org, and we will get those questions answered for you. This has been Community Alert, sponsored by the California Fire Safe Council. Not if, but win positive preparation for disaster on KZSB AM 1290 and newspress.com. See you next week.
This has been Community Alert. Not if, but when. Positive preparation for disaster with Ted Adams and Mike Williams. Community Alert is produced by the Wildland Residents Association, San Marcos Pass Volunteer Fire Department, and sponsored by the California Fire Safe Council. Technical support for Community Alert provided by Richard Dugan and Jim Williams. Community Alert, not if, but when, on KZSB AM 1290, your News Press radio station.